Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And we're in the same room today.
Woo!
So you're done in DC.
I am done in DC, and I am actually happy to be back in California.
Yeah, yeah. How was your research?
It was really good. I am basically in the process of like collating all of it and going through all of it. I have a giant USB drive full of PDFs, but I am happy that one big chunk of my research is over. My conference was finished this weekend,
Yeah. And
first conference ever, I presented, I survived.
So great.
I got a laugh line. It was pretty awesome.
Hey, a laugh line's hard to get.
Yep.
Especially when you're talking about
Theodore Roosevelt and Native American water rights. Yeah.
tough crowd.
Yeah.
That's great. And so I'm so excited to have you here. And then you're going to be going back to UC Berkeley
mm-hmm. And
living your very smart life. Today we have a packed show. We always have a packed show.
A lot of stuff is happening. It's not a quiet August.
So first, we're actually going to tackle way more stories than we normally do. I feel like I'm feeling bullish because we're here together in person.
I think we can manage it.
Yeah.
I think we can get through it without going bananas.
Yeah, we'll see. So we're going to start. We're going to talk about some fuel efficiency requirements that are being frozen within the Trump administration. And then also a tax cut for the rich that Trump is considering doing via executive order. And these two stories I want to talk more about in an illustrative sense and what they mean on the landscape of Trump's political life and less about the stories themselves. So they are both very important and stories that tend to slip to the back when we have so much else to talk about. We're also going to talk about the NRA. There was an incendiary article in the Rolling Stone over the weekend about how the NRA is collapsing or losing money or some shit. It's basically playing the victim, but it's a very fascinating story. And I think it also reveals something a little bit hidden
about the modern conservative party.
Exactly. Then we are still going to talk about Kids at the Border and what's going on there. And there's also a new travel ban lawsuit being heard in Northern California. It's not challenging the travel ban itself, but it's more talking about the transparency of the process. And then also a little bit about the cap in refugee immigration that the Trump administration is trying to set forward. So basically, we have so much to talk about and we have to get right into it.
Yeah, it's intense. It's been a intense week. Okay, Devin, what's been going on with the EPA and fuel efficiency standards?
Well, the EPA, who lost its storied leader, Scott Pruitt, just recently. I mean, look, I've long said that the only reason Scott Pruitt had a job for as long as he did and he got away with as many scandals as he did was because he was hired for a specific reason. And that reason was to create policy and roll back initiatives that protected our environment. And one of those that I actually reported on a couple of months ago was the fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE requirements, so they're called. So during the Obama administration, the EPA and the Obama administration had set standards to increase fuel efficiency in cars to a theoretical 55 miles per gallon by 2025. So this was aimed at reducing emissions and protecting our environment. Also, there is a racial and class justice here.
Yeah.
Because those that are most affected by bad air quality, smog, and pollution tend to be people of color and poor people.
Because it is located in cities, especially in cities with a lot of businesses, but people actually don't live there. And
right.
So they're just traveling there for work. And it's just, it's how our society works. It's how, not to go all socialist on you, but it's literally how capitalism works, is that it puts the onus on the people who do not deserve it the most.
Right, exactly. There's this principle in environmental science called NIMBY, not in my backyard. And the more money you have, the more access to political resources you have, the less likely it is that you're going to get a refinery plant in your neighborhood.
Yep.
You know, they're going to go in neighborhoods where people don't have a say in what goes up there. So, I say all of this, and I'm rambling a little bit, to make the point that this was always a main goal of the Trump administration. And so now the administration announced plans on Thursday to freeze this fuel efficiency standard and to actually roll it back.
Yeah.
Now, here's the main problem with that. The main problem is California, because California, we have a reputation for cars, obviously, and for smog. And back in the 80s, smog was so bad. I mean, you could barely breathe in Los Angeles.
It was basically impossible to breathe. And it's still pretty high. It's still pretty high compared to other states. But we've made huge progress under unlikely governors like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right. Well, and so California has a special provision with the EPA that says we are allowed to set higher standards than even the federal government requires. Mm-hmm. So one example that I like to talk about that people often don't realize is that in California, when you pump gas, there's like a plastic sleeve over the gas hose. And that's not there in other states. And that is designed to trap like micro emissions from the entry point of your car and the gas pump. So right there, you're creating less pollution just at that one point by putting this plastic sleeve over it. Most states don't do that. So this is creating a problem because the Trump administration, if they freeze these standards, California is going to be like, you do whatever the fuck you want. We're going to keep our standards right where they are.
States' rights, bitch.
States' rights, bitch. You want to talk about states' rights and getting a small federal government and getting the fuck out of my issues? Like, here you go. Here you go.
But that's what's so infuriating about the EPA and the Trump administration. States' rights only counts for red states, apparently. Right. Because California is literally saying, fine, you know what? Do whatever the fuck you want. We want to do what we want.
Right.
We want to make sure people can breathe. We want to make sure we have clean air in this state. And we are going to have the emission standards we want to have because it's been working here. It isn't screwing with the car companies.
Right.
Car companies are still selling cars to our customers.
Weirdly, everybody in California drives by a car.
This is also true. Car companies have also said they don't actually want this. It only helps them in the short term.
Right.
Because in the long term, people will end up buying fewer cars.
Right.
And people will end up buying the cheaper cars with better fuel emission standards from countries abroad.
Right.
Because American manufacturers will no longer have to stick by these emission standards.
Right.
So they'll fall behind
in the technology.
In the technology from foreign companies.
Right.
So, you know, Japan is already so ahead of us. China is ahead of us. Other car manufacturers like Germany are already ahead of us. This is actually helping them.
Yeah.
Right? So you would think that a pro-business administration would want to look at, how do I really help business? You know how I really want to pick winners, because that is what Trump likes to do, pick winners and losers? I would look at what car companies need, and they need to be better at technology, especially in fuel emission standards, because people are becoming more environmentally conscious in the cars they choose. So we're going to help them do that by increasing fuel emission standards. A side benefit is, we don't burn the planet 10 years sooner.
Well, and the other thing about that car manufacturers are not excited about here is that if California is – if the Trump administration can't take their California special waiver away, that means that car companies are looking at two different sets of standards that they're going to have to design to. Because cars that don't meet California standards will be banned from California. California is a big fucking state. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but like a lot of people live here. And it's a huge market share. And creating a stratification of the market like that does no one any good. Again, I'm not anti-capitalism. I'm anti not thinking your fucking ideas through before you put them out into the world.
Yeah. I don't know if people have read Carl Polanyi out there in the audience, but basically he is this 20th century philosopher, economist, and he writes this book called The Great Transformation. And he has just one line that anyone needs to remember about him is laissez-faire was planned, planning was not. Basically, what he means is the free market or laissez-faire actually took planning. It took government intervention to actually create a quote-unquote free market as we know it today. But that planning that we had to do over the 20th century, that wasn't actually – libertarians didn't think we needed that.
Right.
You know, Hayek and Mises were like, we don't actually need planning to make it run well. The market will choose the winners and losers properly. But it hasn't.
Right.
We needed government intervention. We needed social democracies to provide social insurance programs, right? And so think of fuel emission standards as a social insurance program which provides clean air and clean water to people who need it. And now you're creating a standard that's different in California and different in the rest of the states. So it's going to mess with the whole market of automobiles. And it's the same thing that's happening in Obamacare. Certain states like Idaho, et cetera, are offering like reinsurance. They're offering cheaper insurance plans. They're messing with the Obamacare system. And then because Congress repealed the individual mandate, you have different standards in different states because some states don't have Medicaid expansion, et cetera, et cetera. And that's another reason why premiums are going up and up and up.
Right.
Besides Trump administration's explicit sabotage.
Well, it's interesting because we all can, you know, it's easy. It's not actually easier to talk about healthcare, but you see it very clearly in this very contained social experiment, if you will. But this is another great example of that. And fucking with the markets like this is just not smart, especially when these people running this operation are not smart either. Yeah. This also goes to the next story I want to talk about, which is the Trump administration wants to make a unilateral tax cut via executive order that would affect only the richest Americans. I'm talking top 0.1%. Because what it does is it changes the way capital gains are taxed. So capital gains taxation was a hot topic, very sexy, when Mitt Romney was running. Yeah. Against Obama in 2008.
Because Mitt Romney worked for Bain, as people might remember.
Yes. And most of his income was through capital gains. And capital gains are historically, because of the way it's set up, taxed at a much lower rate. And so that's where this whole, like, Mitt Romney only pays 20% in taxes comes from, which is true because of the way capital gains are taxed. And you don't want to double tax dividends.
You know, people may have arguments for or against capital gains. I actually don't care. But the notion of giving another $100 billion tax cut to just rich people. This isn't like giving a tax cut to, like, your everyday person in any state in the world, any state in the country you pick. I don't care if it's coastal, red state, blue state, whatever. It's giving a tax cut to purely rich people.
Right.
And so it doesn't even help the quote-unquote forgotten man that Trump has been talking about since 2016 or whatever. And Mnuchin just straight up announces this.
Right.
And I distinctly remember a bunch of Republicans getting very angry anytime Obama picked up a pen and wrote and signed an executive order.
Right.
But now Trump can apparently sign whatever executive order he wants if it's in service of rich white people.
Well, and also what's interesting is that this is a tax reform that was considered by Bush Sr. in 92. And ultimately he decided not to do it because he felt that it wasn't appropriate to do tax cuts and you know, treasury decisions without Congress.
Yep.
And the power of the purse. So really these two stories we've picked to illustrate the sort of unintended consequences. You know, we talked a lot about last week about intended policy consequences,
yeah.
Right? And what the intention behind some of these things are. And the fact of the matter is that it's obvious that this administration is not thinking through policy consequences at all. But when they are, it's never about actually, you know, it's always about creating tax cuts for the rich and making this corporate welfare state more expand.
Because if you think about it, the way that Obama and other presidents who actually believed in climate change, you know, enact policies, the way they other liberals or conservatives enact tax policies is they actually try to understand what the market will do in response to this. And they go, how far can I push the market? Because I do want to intervene in the market. Obama did want to intervene in the market and help, you know, stop climate change. And so it's not about whether you want to intervene or not. It's about actually understanding what consequences it's going to have. And what's clear with these two stories is Mnuchin and the new EPA secretary and Pruitt, they don't care what the consequences
right.
are. They just have this idea, this is going to help automobile people, at least in the near term, or this is going to help, you know, rich investors, at least in the near term. But they have no idea how this could affect the economy in the future because
And
I think they don't care. Because one thing I learned is that technically the $1 trillion tax cut that was passed last year and this $100 billion tax cut, you can call it supply-side economics, but it's also sort of a short-term stimulus,
right?
Like George W. Bush's stimulus early in his presidency. And that stimulus, it may be good for the short term, but that effect evaporates really quickly, especially with
right.
you know, the Federal Reserve is increasing interest rates. So all this complicated stuff is happening, and we know the president doesn't care about this complicated stuff.
Nor does he understand it.
And so it's really frightening to see that even people who are hired to be experts in this, quote-unquote, don't care either. Even for their own reputation, because they're going to be remembered for these policies.
Right, right. And it just doesn't matter to them. So it's a fascinating look into the almost the psychology of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So the next thing I want to talk about before we move on is the NRA. So Varsha and I, when she got here, because it's so exciting to have her here in person, of course we were bullshitting for 45 minutes before we started recording. But we were talking specifically about this NRA story because the Rolling Stone wrote this piece saying that the NRA, I was going to read the headline, quote, "The NRA says it's in deep financial trouble, maybe, quote, unable to exist." So
smallest violin ever placed.
Tiniest little violin. So here's the thing. And I think Shannon Watts tweeted about this and said something to the effect of like, they're fucking with you.
They're bullshitting.
They're bullshitting. And they're making themselves out to be the victim here. And they're trying to get sympathy. They still have donors. They're still taking in money. They're still doing all this. So what I want to talk about is actually has nothing to do with
whether or not they're going out of business.
Exactly. I don't care. Because honestly, they're probably not.
They're definitely not. Like even if they are one day, it wouldn't end the fact that every single Republican donor is bought and paid for by gun manufacturers.
Right.
The gun manufacturers have just cut out the middleman, which is the NRA,
right.
And go straight to the Republican officials, right? And I really like what you have to talk about, and I want to learn more.
Yeah. So basically what is fascinating about this is because the NRA is suing New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, claiming that, quote, the NRA has been subject to state-led blacklisting campaigns that has inflicted tens of millions of dollars in damage. So basically they're whining. The NRA is saying Andrew Cuomo is being mean and telling companies not to work with us. So their biggest issue right now is that they are having trouble getting insurance.
Yeah.
So we just talked a lot about free market, laissez-faire, and in this the capitalist structure with which we work within. And in that structure, a private company is allowed to not do business with you.
It really is, because the First Amendment doesn't apply to private companies.
Right.
It's just the government that can say that can't say where and where you can't speak, right? And so basically, the NRA has this own insurance policy, which itself is fucked up. Basically, it'll give money to its members if they are in a lawsuit that legal costs incurred after firing a legal gun, right? And they marketed this to people in New York, and New York regulators were like, no, this is wrong. You're, quote, unlawfully provided liability insurance to gun owners for certain acts of intentional wrongdoing, right? And so the money behind this insurance policy, other businesses that are providing the money for the NRA to provide this branded product, pulled out.
Right.
And the NRA is claiming, oh, they only pulled out because the governor was mean to us and is censoring us. No.
No.
That's not what's happening.
What Andrew Cuomo did say was he basically said, like, New York businesses, look at your life, look at your choices. You know? Like, look at who you're doing business with and their reputation and if you want to continue to do business with them. He did not say, do not do business with the NRA. He did not say you are forbidden from doing business with the NRA. These companies that the NRA is working with are saying, you know what? I don't really want to work with you.
I don't want to work with you. Even companies that probably would make a quick buck working with them, right? Because I'm sure these businesses that have been working with the NRA for so long have been making profit. And even then, they're pulling out, right? And this is because the way the NRA has conducted itself in the past year, it doesn't look good.
Right.
It doesn't look good. And people are finally noticing, though, because, like, I noticed before 2018, no one really paid attention to NRA TV, which is one of the most horrific things in existence. And only recently have people really been paying attention to it because people on NRA TV, like Dana Loesch, et cetera, have been, like, explicitly attacking the press and saying stuff that has nothing to do with gun control, nothing to do with gun rights at all. They've been saying stuff about, like, the media, Black Lives Matter protesters. It's so bizarre. And finally, people are realizing, and private companies and people who work at these private companies are realizing, hey, this is weird. And then when they get in trouble, like this
insurance company,
like this insurance company did, they finally realize, oh, why risk the liability?
Right.
Let's ditch this place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's also interesting because, again, this goes directly back to the power of the dollar and voting with your dollar. And this is something that the right and the NRA in particular love to do. Like, boycott Starbucks because their cups are red instead of Christmas trees, right? Like, I mean, obviously everyone's like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's totally going to work. But then when it actually happens to them, they're like, wait, this isn't fair.
Yeah, they will boycott Starbucks because of, like, not no Christmas cups. But then they get angry when people boycott a Chick-fil-A. Right. I don't understand.
Right, exactly.
And so now that the market is reacting negatively to them, they want government intervention.
In the market. That's why I wanted to talk about the story.
And so the state of the Conservative Party is not good.
It's not good, Bob.
Not good.
It's not good, Bob. Yeah. Oh, there's also a super interesting nugget in here. In Rolling Stone, they said that the most recent financial disclosure shows that the NRA overspent by nearly $46 million in 2016. I don't know if this necessarily fits in with this lawsuit exactly, but what I will say is that in 2016, the NRA spent $61 million on congressional races that year, and they spent $31 million on Trump's race in particular. And so that's a whole fuck ton of money. That's way more than $46 million. So it's interesting because now they're saying, oh, we're doing poorly financially after they overspent in the 2016 election cycle, and they pumped tons of money into that election. And so, yeah, like you said, they want market intervention at the same time the EPA is making a case against market intervention.
It's a classic case of, I only want help when I'm in trouble. I refuse to help you, right? You know, every few weeks or so, some stupid economist writes a story. What if we privatized libraries, right? And so there's this tweet that goes around every few weeks that in response to that is like, if somebody had come up with the idea of libraries today, Republicans would cry bloody murder.
Right.
And that's basically what the NRA is doing. They're basically asking for a socialist intervention in their market share to help boost their organization.
Right. Because they can't get insurance.
Because they can't get insurance and they can't market insurance to people who fire guns. It's it's bananas.
It's bananas. It's
and
absolutely bananas.
At the same time, the Trump administration is claiming, conservatives are claiming, we can't intervene in the market to help people breathe clean air because it hurts car companies. It makes no sense.
It makes no sense. So that is why I thought the NRA story was a nice little nugget, because, again, they're not going under. This is completely them crying and being victims. But at the same time, like, it's not good, Bob. All right, Varsha, so let's jump into kind of our next block. We're going to start with kids at the border and the family reunification mess. So can you tell us what's going on there?
The federal judge overseeing the court order reunification of the 2,500 migrant children is not happy. And the reason he is not happy is because the remaining 572 children in the government's custody are still not reunited with their parents.
Right.
And he is commenting on the slow pace of this progress. Basically, the ACLU and Judge Dana Sabra are saying, hey, Trump administration, this is, quote, unacceptable at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the polite legal way of saying, you shit the bed here, guys. Like, fix it.
Yeah, and I love what Sabra, like, said. He's like, quote, many of these parents were removed from the country without their child. All of this is the result of the government separation and then inability and failure to track and reunite. He's being very clear that this is the government's fault. Because the way when you hear Kirstjen Nielsen, Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump, Sarah Sanders, etc., they all try to put the onus on the parents for bringing the kids here in the first place.
Yeah. Well, they all want credit for solving a problem they created. It's like a fireman who starts fires to be the hero.
Yeah. And the thing is, this is what really bothers me about this, and this fits with the first couple stories we talked about too, is if they had just put ankle bracelets on these families and brought them back for their trials and then deported them, like refused them asylum, which they were going to do anyway, none of this would have happened. Their base still would have been happy because they're not accepting asylum refugees, but now they don't have a bunch of bananas lawsuits against them. But they insisted on being cruel. Why? Because Stephen Miller apparently loves pictures of kids crying in cages.
Yeah. I mean, this is we've talked about this before. This is cruelty. It's creating its own problem and then not being able to solve it, being that inept. They are unable to solve a problem that they created. And this judge is basically like, yeah, this is not a thing. There are 410 children who have parents that are currently outside of the U.S. and who were likely deported prior to reunification. Yeah. And this judge is basically like, that sounds like a you problem, bro. Like, go find them.
Right? And this is similar to the other stories as well, is because the judge is not trying to like end family separation completely, because there already is an injunction against it. The Trump administration issued an executive order no longer doing it, but maybe they still are. But now the judge is saying, create a goddamn process.
Right.
Government is about process. You clearly don't have a process.
Right.
And that's what he's appalled at, and that is what the country is appalled at. It seems as if the Trump administration separated these children with no intention of ever putting them back together.
That's it. That's what it is.
And that's just so unbelievably cruel, because I can't understand it, but I can maybe accept the fact that the administration insisted on being this cruel but still created a plan, right? But now what it looks like is that they were intentionally just trying to orphan these kids.
Yeah. Well, and this judge even said, to continue the quote that you did, quote, the reality is that for every parent who is not located, there will be a permanently orphaned child, and that is 100% the responsibility of the administration. So putting this squarely on them, because it is on them. Outcomes of these policies, they were not working towards a policy outcome. they're not working towards ending any sort of immigration. They were not working towards crafting a new narrative about immigration. Their whole intent was to be cruel.
We could have had a smart lady in the White House. We wouldn't have seen her face for 4 years.
Yeah.
And taco trucks on every corner. Instead, we got baby jails.
Yeah.
Vote, people.
Vote.
Vote, yeah. Please. Because, again, it really is about the process. And I understand that this wasn't, like, a really sexy topic in 2016. But it apparently is getting pretty sexy in 2018 because people want to talk about Medicare for All. They want to talk about our tax policy that actually helps people in the middle class and poor class. They want to talk about a federal jobs guarantee. Like, policy is interesting. It's just we have to really talk about what we care about. And one thing we care about is not putting kids in jail.
Well, and you know, I'm only laughing because it's almost like a nervous response, right? It's not actually funny. It's more just like that, like the most 2018 aesthetic is us having to say that we are opposed to baby jails.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're also opposed to the next story.
Yes.
Which
so,
is
speaking of process, speaking yeah. of process. So there is a lawsuit being against Kirstjen Nielsen and the State Department by a group in Northern California alleging that the travel ban, which is now law because the court ruled that it's allowed to be law.
Fuck you, Anthony Kennedy.
Exactly. But in this travel ban, in this law, there is supposed to be a waiver process. So there's supposed to be a way to get waivers to this and bring people who have need or have connection to the U.S. into the U.S. So this lawsuit is saying, so there is no process, and it's a sham because they're saying that there's a process, but in reality, it's just a way to deny all waiver claims and all waiver applications.
Basically, there are a bunch of immigration lawyers across the country who've been working to help people who are affected by the travel ban get waivers if they need to, right? But almost all of them are being denied. And this is my problem with the Roberts opinion of the travel ban, because Roberts, in his opinion, insisted that even though he only got a few pages of process notes and background info from the administration, he insisted, oh, there must have been so much more discussion about how to enact this policy and, you know, make sure these waivers get through. And the liberal justices were like, no, bro, no. They clearly have no idea what they're doing. And now it's borne fruit that they have no idea what they're doing. But also, not only do they have no idea, they're intentionally making it hard for people who have a clear and proper case to be allowed into the country and to get a waiver not to get in the country.
Right. So they're saying that this waiver process is a big old sham, right? And that there is no waiver process. It was used as an argument to push this travel ban into law. But then in practice, so on paper, there's a process. In reality, there's not. So yeah. So consular officers, who are the ones who are supposed to be approving applications that they come in, they are supposed to consider whether applicants meet three criteria. One, that they would suffer, quote, undue hardship if not allowed to come to the United States. Two, that letting them come wouldn't hurt the U.S.'s national security or public safety, which are
pretty obvious.
Pretty obvious. Like, and those are also words put in there to, like, make Trump's base happy, right?
Yeah.
Like,
because these people are already vetted if they're going to come to the U.S.
Exactly. And then three, that it would be in the, quote, national interest of the United States to admit them. So basically what this lawsuit is saying is that it's obviously not supposed to be an exhaustive list, and it's pretty vague. So what exactly do those three things mean? How do we implement them? And what are kind of the standards that these consular officers are using? And so then this is where it becomes a game of kick the can and pass the buck. So consular officers are saying it's not really up to them and they don't really have power to make these decisions. And the government is then saying, oh, it's all up to the consular officers making these decisions. So it's this circular, like, no, it's their problem. And so what we do know is that about 996 people have been cleared for waivers. That doesn't mean they've gotten a waiver. It means they've been cleared to possibly get a waiver. And the first statistics that the government has released after the travel ban went into effect after the Supreme Court ruling is that two waiver approvals out of more than 6,000 applications were approved. Two.
That doesn't seem significant.
That doesn't seem like a waiver process.
That really doesn't.
That sounds like a statistical fluke.
It really does. And it probably seems like there was like maybe like two people who really, really deserved it out of them.
But they don't even have standards for what that would mean. Like,
yeah.
What did those two people have on their applications that other people didn't? That's what they want to know. They're not even saying, we're not challenging the legality of the travel ban at this point.
Yeah.
We're saying, how the fuck do we get a waiver?
Exactly.
Like this.
Because the thing is, you can't have policy on je ne sais quoi quality.
Exactly.
Like, that's not how policy works, right. Especially immigration policy, when you are trying to, when Donald Trump is insisting, quote unquote, that he wants a merit-based system, you have to find a way to judge the goddamn merit, right? And right. So obviously he doesn't want a merit-based system because that wouldn't allow for his racist, I only want Scandinavian countries coming here.
Right.
But if he wants to pretend that he has a merit-based system, he has to have an actual policy behind it, right. Or the courts are going to continue to strike down his process.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think Gorsuch and Roberts can save him, no matter how racist he wants to go, right?
Right.
If he goes more racist than he already is, I don't know if the Supreme Court can save him again.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the thing is it's obvious that there was no process.
Yeah.
And again, this goes back to solving a problem that they created. There was no process to reunify parents and children. There's no process for waivers. There was no intent to make this a fair and legal law.
Yeah.
This was about keeping people out, and not just keeping people out on the basis of national security. And I'm doing air quotes here because, you know, whenever you throw the word national security around, it's really just code for brown people.
Yeah.
Right? It's code for people who are different and othered and scary, right? And we don't want them.
Yeah.
So there was never any process, and they never wanted a legal way to actually let people in.
And basically the reason, like, the courts are playing an important role in both these stories, the migrant children and this travel ban story, is that the court can't create this policy, right?
Right.
So Roberts, like, he desperately tries to defend the travel ban in that opinion back in June. And this Judge Sabra is desperately trying to say, hey, like, I understand why you did the separation, even if he doesn't understand it. Or I understand what you're saying, but you still have to have a policy to bring them back together. You can't just orphan children.
Right.
That is against the Constitution.
Right.
I don't know which article it's against, but it's definitely against some amendment.
Somewhere in there it says, do not intentionally orphan children. Although, honestly, as that's coming out of my mouth, I'm like, maybe it is.
Maybe it's in there somewhere. I'm not sure. But I that's what I'm saying is, like, the court can't create policy.
Right.
And especially conservative justices aren't going to try to create policy.
Right, they would call them
activist
choices.
At least distinctive process, like, actions, right? So, like,
right.
The reason Roberts defends this travel ban, and the reason any Republican defends this travel ban, or good faith Republican, is because there's this waiver process.
Right.
And what we have revealed is that at every level of the Trump administration, there is no process.
Right.
They have no idea what they're doing, nor do they care.
Yeah. 2 out of 6,000 is not a waiver process. That's just saying there's one and then holding up. It's the exceptional woman in the patriarchy, right? Well, I mean, you even kind of alluded to it. Like, those two people must have really needed it. And it kind of goes back to this idea of, like, there's no patriarchy. If you're pretty enough and smart enough and feminine enough and tough but not ball busting, you know, then you too will succeed in the patriarchy, women. You know what I mean? That's Ivanka Trump, right? They hold her up. Like, oh, but look at Ivanka Trump. There's no patriarchy because there couldn't be Ivanka Trump. That's what this is. Well, if it's really, really important, like, we've approved 2 people.
Exactly.
2 whole people. So obviously there's a way to do it and there's a process and we don't need to tell you about it because it's there, obviously, really. Yeah.
It's just, it's so frustrating. And, like, obviously everyone says this every single time, but malevolence and the incompetence are really battling it out.
really
battling it out. And usually they end up in a tie and it's just bullshit for everyone.
Right.
But it's so frustrating when you see, like, the level of incompetence and you're just like, how did you get a job here?
Yeah.
It's so frustrating.
Yeah. Well, and to add some shit icing to that shit cake, the White House also wants another reduction in refugees admitted to the United States. And this goes back to the national security language that I was talking about and the safety of the nation. Again, these are the phrases that get used when this administration wants to scare its base and say, well, we have to stop immigration because there are scary people out there who shouldn't be in this country. And this also goes back to in February of this year, and I can't make this up, and we reported on it back in February, the DOJ released a report saying that most of the terrorist attacks that have happened in the United States have been perpetrated by someone who is not born here, which is not true.
Not true at all.
And if you look at the underlying data, and the underlying information and statistics that they were using, they were intentionally manipulating it. And they were intentionally creating incendiary narrative around it.
Yeah.
So our own Department of Justice is doing this. And they use that, and they can hold that up and say, we don't want people who weren't born here because they are the ones who perpetrate acts of terrorism. You know who, like, the most likely person to be a terrorist is?
Oh, white man.
White
who
men.
Owns a gun.
White men who own a gun. So you want to talk about terrorism? Let's get into it. But right now we're not talking about terrorism. We're talking about refugees. And so they're using this paradigm that they've set up to yell national security from the rooftops. And they want to cap the number of refugees at...
at no more than 25,000.
No more than 25,000.
Basically, I think last year they wanted it at Mr. Miller... as the New York Times calls him. I call him Stephen, the worst person ever. Steve Miller basically wanted a limit as low as 15,000, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
Right? And then they settled on, I think, 45,000, which is still historically low. And then they want to cut it even more, I think, more than 40% this year. And this would be like the lowest since the creation of the program in 1980. Yeah. And again, this program was created under like Ronald Reagan, right? It's not un-Republican, it's not undemocratic, it's not un-American to accept refugees, because no matter how much we want to, like, disparage, like, certain aspects of what we've done in the, like, early 20th century, immigrants have found their way here.
Right.
They have made their lives here, they have built their lives here, they have created communities here, and they have succeeded here and thrived here. And no matter how much we want to disparage them, as we have throughout history, they have succeeded here. And so at some point, political parties, both political parties, realized, I guess we got to get on the side of immigrants, right?
Right.
And only recently has the Republican Party decided, screw that, we're going to go the other way.
Right.
Right? Because as early as... the Reagan and H.W. Bush administrations, they were all in favor of providing quote-unquote amnesty.
Right.
Even George W. Bush tried to pass immigration reform, but it fell because of hardliners from the right.
Would you talk about like a free market capitalist structure?
Yeah.
Immigration is good.
It really
for
is.
Free market structure. And so to you have to really like thread that needle if you want to be anti-immigration and pro-unchecked capitalism. I'm not saying that... pro-unchecked capitalism is even a bad thing. I'm not making any sort of value judgments whatsoever. I mean, my personal beliefs aside, but I'm saying that you can't believe both.
You really can't. And the reason they're able to succeed in quote-unquote believing both is because they pretend to believe both.
Right.
But really what they believe in is an unchecked system of white supremacy.
Right.
And in an unchecked system of white supremacy, white people get all the capital they want. They get all the government intervention they want to support their government needs.
NRA.
Yeah. High NRA. High when it comes to helping. No work requirements for red states
right.
with Medicaid. No hurting Medicare or Social Security in red states,
right.
No hurting the environment in rich areas,
right.
No paying taxes for rich white people,
on capital gains.
Yeah, and no immigration when it comes to jobs that white people do,
right.
Right? And so that is the kind of regulation they want. They want to regulate in such a way so they can have unchecked white supremacy.
Exactly.
And that is what's the common thread here. Right?
Of all of these stories, all of these stories are just one... denouement. It's the denouement of this story is white supremacy.
Yeah. And this is why I don't understand why in 2018 there are still quote unquote small c conservatives out there who may defend the Republican Party.
Right.
Because the Republican Party is no longer a small c conservative party.
Nope.
It is a big wolf whistle of white supremacy. That is what it does.
Exactly.
It is a machine for white supremacists. Like, I feel bad for certain Republicans, and I am proud of certain Republicans who have left the Republican Party because they realize that this is all that it's doing right now. It is unchecked white supremacy. And it's also unchecked white male supremacy. I should
yes.
make that clear.
Yeah.
And there are white women who, like, get their way.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Ivanka Trump.
Exactly.
Right? Because if you're rich and you're white, you get access to abortion. You
right.
get access to healthcare, right? But
there's no patriarchy. Look at Ivanka Trump.
Exactly. And so that is what this refugee plan is all about.
Exactly.
It is about unchecked white supremacy, because you could technically have a Republican like Ben Sasse, like Paul Ryan, who really do believe in better immigration systems because it would help their market.
Help
business. But the reason they don't pass it is because they're afraid of the hard right, which is a machine for white supremacy.
Exactly. So, and the other thing about this is, again, throwing around these terms, national security, it's, you know, this fear mongering, right? And I had a conversation with a family member over the weekend, and we were talking about immigration. And she was like, well, it's just not smart to let people into this country unvetted. Like, of course we have to, you know, limit the number of refugees because that's how bad people get in. And this is also a woman who loves to talk about how terrible it was that FDR refused a boat full of Jewish refugees during World War II and sent them back to Europe. And she was like, he just sent them back to die. And I'm like, how is that different from Syrian refugees?
It isn't.
Exactly.
And the problem with that argument, because this is the argument, quote, definitely white supremacist Tucker Carlson makes on Fox News. This is the argument that every other Fox News host at nighttime makes, is like, why is vetting so bad? Because the way you're talking about vetting is that, one, you're assuming vetting doesn't already happen.
Right. It does.
It really does. It's really hard to come into this country. Even if you just want to be a student here for 4 years, even if you just want to visit, it is hard to come here. Right? That is one level. But you're also adding another level of quote-unquote vetting. And the way you're saying that word, it just shows white people that, yeah, we're together on this.
Right.
We're only going to let certain types of people in the country.
And then the vetting becomes code for a process that makes it impossible to accept refugees of color.
Yeah. And it also assumes that if refugees of color are not accepted, it's because the vetting process worked.
Exactly. Not because it was too arduous or,
yeah,
or unfair.
Exactly. And that's the same thing when it comes to like voting rights or voter ID, right? Like Donald Trump this past weekend was like, you need ID to buy groceries. That is not true. You don't need ID to buy groceries. I don't even think I need ID to pay with my credit card. I only need ID if I'm buying alcohol or cigarettes or a lottery ticket, right? Like, that's the only time you need ID.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he used that you need ID to buy groceries to champion voter ID.
Right.
And the way Republicans defend voter ID, they're like, you're supposed to love regulation, right? And if the regulation hurts people from voting, that's because they didn't have the proper ID. They did it wrong.
Right.
People have colored it wrong because they couldn't afford
it. It moves the onus, right.
It moves the onus on people. And that is what, that is what this refugee system
is doing. It's moving the onus.
It's, you know, the lack of waivers in the travel ban, this decreasing of refugee, like the decreasing refugee cap. It's saying that you have to prove to us that you are good enough.
Right.
To come to this country.
And you have to trust that there is a process in place.
Yeah.
Right? That vetting is actually occurring or that these waivers are actually being looked at.
Yeah.
High 2 out of 6,000. They're obviously not being looked at. So it forces you to put faith in a process that doesn't exist. And it shifts culpability to the person, not the government.
Yeah. Because the thing is, obviously, if you are applying to come into this country, you have evidence that you deserve to be here.
Right.
Either because you're a student, either because you're just visiting, either because you have deep hardship or whatever
reason you
have. Family ties or whatever, right? You are proving that you have the reason. And so by quote-unquote asking for increased vetting, you're basically saying no matter what you do, you can't come in here.
Right.
And that's just so frustrating. And this, again, is where it really just bothers me that these people, specifically Trump administration officials, don't care what their policy does. Because, like, even if I was the most cold-hearted bitch of a Republican, I would dislike these policies because it hurts tourism. It hurts universities being able to recruit the best students. It hurts businesses.
Right.
Like, the only way Trump's Mar-a-Lago suite is able to get foreign workers is by applying for a special waiver.
Yeah.
And he gets that waiver.
Weird. Wait, so weird how that works.
So weird how
Trump
gets
that
a waiver for foreign workers on his golf course, but other people can't.
All right, Varsha, so let's do a quick gratitude check. So what's getting you through the day today?
So what's getting me through the day is that I, as you all know, I just had my first conference on Saturday. It was the West Coast branch of the American Historical Association, and I presented on Theodore Roosevelt, and it was a lot of fun. But also, it was really good to just prove to myself and to people who were actually in the audience that I can write something, present it, and actually like make an argument. And it really just reinforces for myself that I'm not just, like, having fun here.
No.
I'm trying to achieve something, and it felt really good. Like, obviously this paper wasn't perfect. This is my first try, but it felt really good to put it out there.
Look, it was really good. It was 30 pages, and I read it because it was actually quite compelling. And I also drunk texted you my feelings about this guy named Andrew McCool.
Yeah, and so it was a lot of fun to write, and it was a lot of fun to like research because I was in the Library of Congress, like looking through stuff that Theodore Roosevelt writes to other people, and that stuff his advisors wrote to other people. So it was a lot of fun to do, and I'm just really grateful for the fact that I get to read for a living and write for a living. Right. It's a lot of fun. And then another thing I'm grateful for is a meme that's going around. As people might know, Donald Trump, our president, basically admitted that the Trump Tower meeting in 2016 wasn't actually about adoption. It was about getting dirt on your on your opponent, which is like totally awesome or something. I don't know the exact Trump tweet. I don't want to quote it. But the thing is, this meme has been going around the internet. Is like people are like taking pictures with their friends and going like, the meeting is primarily about adoptions. And so Representative Judy Chu posted a tweet with her and a puppy. And she tweets, this meeting was primarily about adoption. And I'm losing my mind. And there are other people doing this. And it's so much fun that we can find joy in like the tiny things that are happening. Like last week, Manafort gets dinged in his trial because he buys like a $50,000 ostrich coat. And I'm finding joy in that.
Exactly.
I'm finding a little bit of joy in that he bought this ridiculous ostrich coat.
It's also so ugly.
It's so ugly. And his suits are so boxy. Why don't you get a tailor for your suits? What are you doing?
If you're going to spend that much money on a suit, please get it tailored.
And also, like, another thing that's just been giving me joy is the idea that Manafort uses international wire transfers to pay for stuff.
I know.
And I'm thinking about going up to a cashier and, like, he's like, yeah, it's $10. I'm like, yeah, I forgot my wallet. Do you accept an international wire transfer from, like, from Vlad in Russia? And I just, so there's a lot of things I'm grateful for, but one thing is just finding the little joys in life.
Oh, God, yeah.
That, like, Representative Judy Chu and meetings that are primarily about adoption.
This meeting is primarily about adoptions.
It is.
This current one we're having. Yeah, no, it's so good. I'm so grateful. I got to meet, so Crystal is one of our Facebook mods and community managers on the Facebook group, Dickwad's Begun. And she lives in Northern California, but she was down at Disneyland with her family on vacation. And so she asked me if I wanted to meet up. And so yesterday I went with Alex and Hank, our son, and we went to Disneyland and we spent the day at Disneyland with Crystal and her family. And it was so
much fun.
It was so fun. It was great. It was great to meet her in person. It was great. It's just really cool to like make friends online and create like a digital community that sometimes comes into your real life. And it was really cool.
We should really have like an LA party for the Hellions.
All the LA Hellions. We definitely should. All right, Varsha. So our dickwad of this week, I'm gonna go ahead and spoil it. It's Chuck Grassley, who again is like a frequent flyer on this segment. But specifically, he asked the National Archives to produce documents about Kavanaugh's time in the Bush administration by like, oh, I don't know, tomorrow afternoon or something like that. And the National Archives was like, no. So you were just at the National Archives. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about the story and like what's going on here?
Yeah. So a lot of stuff is classified at the archives. And even if it's not classified, right, it's still, like, hard to sift through. There's a lot of paper. And even if it's on a computer, it's really hard to sift through. It's, like, it is really difficult to tell, like, 10 people who are underfunded. The National Archives is underfunded to organize thousands upon thousands upon thousands of documents.
Hundreds of thousands of documents.
Hundreds of thousands of documents by tomorrow. Because not only are they, like, organizing this for this one confirmation hearing, they have to organize a bunch of other stuff for the thousands of people who do research there every day, for the other agencies who need these documents, right? So Chuck Grassley basically gives them a deadline they can't meet. And then complains when Democrats are like, hey, you only requested a few documents, you didn't request all of them. Because Grassley only requested certain documents, not all of the documents from when Kavanaugh was a staff secretary under Bush, right? And also, the reason Chuck Grassley is a dickwad is because he, like Orrin Hatch, are claiming as if like Democrats are these horrible obstructionists that are like refusing a good man, good old Judge Kavanaugh, from being a justice, right? And that just really bothers me because it's as if, like, Merrick Garland never existed. Because Orrin Hatch, senator from Utah, who's retiring, and please don't vote for Mitt Romney this fall. Vote for Jennifer Wilson for Senate. He gives a press conference, and he says something that just, I think it infuriated me for the whole day. I was so angry. So he basically said, I want to really compliment the Democrats who have stood up for Judge Kavanaugh. Manchin, what are you doing? Vote against Kavanaugh. Sorry. I want to really compliment the Democrats who have stood up for Kavanaugh because they realize we can't keep going down this, quote, partisan, picky, stupid, dumbass road that has happened around here for so long. I'm sick and tired of it, to be honest with you. Frankly, we didn't treat their candidates for these positions the way they're treating ours. Orrin Hatch, do you remember Merrick Garland? What are you doing? It makes me so angry. The reason Obama nominated Merrick Garland, who, as every socialist in the country and most liberals like me will tell you, was pretty centrist, is because people like Orrin Hatch told him, nominate a centrist. Don't worry. I'll confirm him.
We got right? you, bro.
And then he refused to meet with him.
Yeah.
So fuck you, Orrin Hatch. Fuck you, Chuck Grassley, for trying to mess with the system. Get all of the documents, and then you can have your damn hearing.
Right.
And so basically, I really want Chuck Schumer to think twice about this. I really want Chuck Schumer to really think, does he want his legacy in the Senate as minority leader, and then maybe one day majority leader, to be, I let a confirmation go through because I didn't try hard enough to get some fucking emails.
Right.
You know, if Republicans can get every goddamn Hillary Clinton email and spend years harping about emails, harp about some emails, Chuck Schumer.
Yeah.
Harp about some emails.
Yeah, seriously. Like, again, Kavanaugh is not just – it was an interesting thing in here. So, basically, all judges, they get requests for documents related to their stuff. So, for Roberts, there was about 70,000 pages of documents. And for Kagan, there was about 170,000 documents. They are looking at 900,000 documents for Kavanaugh because Kavanaugh worked in the Bush administration. He has a long political and judicial career. It's a lot of fucking data to get through. And the other thing is that, so he worked for Bush. So Bush's legal team has been helping out as a, quote, courtesy to speed up this process. Here's the fucking thing. Like you said, a lot of things are confidential or privileged. And so they are getting to decide what is privileged and what's not and what the Senate will ultimately see.
Also, FYI, the day Kavanaugh was nominated by Trump, George W. Bush really, really liked it, yeah. Right? Like, George W. Bush isn't your hero. He is still the guy who is, like, who led us into a war we shouldn't have gone into, still a horrible president, and still crashed the economy, but still loves Kavanaugh. Why? Because Kavanaugh is going to give him the stuff that he wants.
Right.
Like, this is why, like, people who might engage with Republican parties, right? Like, they might be like, I might want to be a Republican one day. Don't do it, man. Don't do it. Because it's not fun. You end up like people like Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch and George W. Bush who argue in bad faith.
Right.
Right? And so I really want to implore people out there who live in either Maine or Alaska or in any red state or in any blue state, call your senator every day. Tell them, one, get every document on Kavanaugh, because there is probably something he said.
I want to see that fucking risotto recipe.
I really do. I want to know how Kavanaugh makes his risotto. I want to know what white wine he uses to drink with
exactly.
it. I want to know everything that he does, right? And the reason I want to know is because not only was he staff secretary under Bush and also a judge after that, before that he worked for Ken Starr. Does anybody remember who Ken Starr is? Oh, yeah. Ken Starr investigated the president for obstruction of justice and lying, Bill Clinton, right? And then suddenly, when George W. Bush, a Republican, became president, Judge Kavanaugh changed his mind as to what constitutes obstruction of justice and when a president can be investigated and when he can't be investigated.
Yep.
These documents are important. You know, they are not like the bad faith email hunt of Hillary Clinton.
Right.
They're actually important documents.
The whole argument for Merrick Garland not getting a confirmation hearing was, you know, it's coming up on an election and we should really let the American people decide. And we should really let them have a say in this.
Yeah.
And so, look, this is not just, like you said, this is not in bad faith. We're not requesting documents that we don't need to see. We're not saying, oh, well, we need all this additional information to, like, do the calculation math, like, hacking. I'm hacking
exactly.
the mainframe.
Exactly.
Like, no, this is legitimate work. This is legitimate research. This is something that people legitimately need to know to make an informed decision. And this is not just running out the clock. And I'm sorry, it is ridiculous to ask the National Archives, which you said is underfunded and understaffed, to produce almost 1 million documents in 3 days.
It wouldn't work. And and obviously Chuck Grassley, dickwad of the week, is doing this on purpose because,
right,
one, either he knows Kavanaugh has said some nasty shit over,
right,
the years in some emails, or done some nasty shit, or supported some nasty shit. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or he just doesn't want to give Democrats any ammo whatsoever.
Right.
And that's what's really problematic here. Like, Republicans under Obama were like, advice and consent is really important. I advise and I do not consent Obama to nominate Merrick Garland.
Right.
Right? But now, apparently, Democrats don't have the same right to advise and consent,
right,
in the Senate.
Right.
And that's just bananas. Again, like, you can argue, if you're a pure constitutionalist, you can argue, fine, Kavanaugh has to be confirmed. I don't care, even if he's, like, you know, the devil incarnate. But if you're a pure constitutionalist,
well, do it right.
Do it right. You still argue that the Senate deserves its process for advice and consent.
And that they get to see these documents. This is not a stalling tactic. This is not a stalling tactic. This is how this process works. We're going to talk, I swear to God, I'm going to name this episode process.
And you know how I know this isn't a stalling tactic? Because if McConnell really, really, really wanted this judge to go through, just in case Democrats won the Senate in November, he could still confirm Kavanaugh in a lame duck session between November and December, right before the new session starts in January 2019, right? So there is a way that we could work really, really hard to stop Kavanaugh and he would still get through, which I know is sad for people listening to this podcast, but there's a way it could happen. And so they're doing this even though they know they have a way out.
Right.
They have a card up their sleeve and they're still obstructing the process. They're the ones obstructing.
And
it's
they
not
know
Democrats.
That's because I think someone knows that there's something real nasty.
There is
there.
Something real nasty in those documents. And again, this is not tinfoil hat me saying this. There is evidence out there that when I think Hillary Clinton or something was giving a press conference in the 1990s,
mm-hmm,
and Kavanaugh was sitting in like not the audience, but he was watching it on TV or something, and he apparently mouthed the word bitch to somebody, and he's not a nice guy to liberals. He is really partisan. And again, you can argue that's fine. You can argue like he is a great jurist and he's fair or whatever the hell you want to say to yourself to convince yourself this is fine. But there still needs to be a proper process, as is the theme of this show. And Democrats aren't asking for anything unreasonable. Even if you count the Democrats who have said from day one they're not going to vote for him, there are still Democrats out there like Manchin, Heitkamp, Shaheen, Baldwin, anybody, right? Donnelly, Nelson, who deserve to see all these documents before they can vote yes or no.
Exactly.
Especially Maine and especially Murkowski and Collins.
Yeah.
Also, please call Murkowski and Collins. Apparently, there are stories around there that they haven't been getting as many calls as they thought they would. So call and tell them to vote against Kavanaugh.
All right, Farsha, last but not least, let's do a couple of quick action items. You kind of alluded to one at the end of the last section. Call your senators about Kavanaugh. Like you said, Collins and Murkowski are not getting as many calls as they thought they would. Remember, with healthcare, we lit the phone lines up and we won. That's how you win. One of my favorite things to say these days is democracy is a contact sport. Like, get in there. Like, you have to do the work. That's how we win the battles.
Yeah, you really have to get dirty. You really have to work out. Like, it's not something, like, as Obama used to say, it's not a spectator sport. Not only is it not a spectator sport, it is a contact sport.
Right.
You can't
This is not golf. You're not golfing.
This bothers me, but I do want to put in some caveats. There are people out there, I have friends out there who say, I vote, that's all I can do. My vote only counts once, that's it, right? Like, actually, no, it doesn't.
Nope.
You can do more. And again, I'm not saying everyone has to do more because there are restrictions on some people. Some people have different schedules.
You do what you can.
You do what you can, right? But if you're not doing everything you can, do you really have a right to complain?
Right.
Like, if the government isn't restricting you from voting, if you aren't a person of color, or a poor person, or an elderly person, or a young person, I guess a lot of people are being suppressed in their votes. Like, you have to do other stuff to get involved.
Right.
And you have to not just ask for your rights, you have to fight for your rights.
Exactly.
And you have to fight for other people's rights. If you can see that people's votes are being suppressed, if you can see that there isn't, like, gerrymandering is going to make it hard for us to take back the House, you have to go out there and do the work. And so the first step to doing the work is to call your senators.
Yeah.
But go beyond that and try to ask a few friends to call their senators.
Right.
Even if you think, oh man, I live in Oregon. It's not going to matter. My senator is going to vote for him against him anyway. Still call.
Still call.
There is a special election today in Ohio's 12th. There were polls this morning that put it within 1 point. And so Danny O'Connor is running. And if he wins, he'll be a Democrat from the seat. And it would be really amazing because it's one less seat we have to win in November. But obviously, if you're not in the 12th district in Ohio and you can't vote in that election, register to vote for you can vote. Even if you are like me, if you're in like Barbara Lee's district or if you're in a super blue district, still register to vote. Why? Because there's a lot of propositions in California you should vote for.
Okay, I was just going to say, propositions are so important. And actually, I talked to Marissa Cabus last week about her project Crush the Midterms.
Yeah.
And it's a really great way, like, to get registered to vote or, you know, to, like, make an action plan. If you're already registered, if you're already doing this, other ways you can get involved, how you can use your skills to help people running in your district. And then we also talked a little bit about possibly, like, you know, researching ballot measures and you know, what's going on. And this is all so important. Midterms are like something like 95 days away now. That is no time whatsoever. So now is the time to register to vote. Now is the time to remind everyone in your life to register to vote and to be that person who doesn't stop talking about it. So that does it for us. Varsha, I'm so happy to have you in studio.
It's so much fun to be in studio.
So much fun. I think this is a great episode. We are going to be doing another episode together on Thursday, and I have a very fascinating interview lined up that I'm sure everyone will love. So thank you for listening so much. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and rate us if you can. In fact, rate us 5 stars because it's the rules of feminism. And follow us on social media. We're at HellBentPod on Twitter and Facebook and
Instagram.
So raise some hell and let's all practice some compassion. HellBent Podcast is a production of HellBent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at HellBentPod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, DickwadsBegone, at facebook.com/groups/DickwadsBegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.